Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries. This morning from Singapore, we have the ex-CEO of Coins.ph and the current head of Coinbase Southeast Asia joining us today. Please welcome Hassan Ahmed. Hassan, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Kunal, thanks for having me.
And how are things with you in light of COVID?
Things are much better now. Singapore has started to reopen, so it's nice to be able to walk outside without a mask, meet friends, go back to the office. So that normalcy is starting to come back, which is really, really nice.
I'm happy to hear that. Let's jump into the first question, shall we?
Let's do it.
So Hassan, tell me about yourself and your background and how it led you to the path of joining Coinbase as their head of Southeast Asia.
Yeah, I feel like everyone who's in crypto or has been crypto for a while has, you know, some sort of interesting story for how they eventually got there. My story is that there's a few different components that are intertwined. I grew up in Pakistan until I went over to the States for college. And so I had a lived experience of being in an emerging economy with a volatile and fluctuating currency and economic shocks to the system. When I was in college, I studied a mix of finance, math, and comp sci. And interestingly enough, at that time, I'd done my honors thesis on elliptic curve cryptography, just really out of interest, not for any kind of professional pursuit. And had sort of kind of dove into that specific topic area under my math major, and then just had kind of put it to the side and gone into traditional finance. So I'd done a few stints in consulting and private equity and wealth management and whatnot. I'd also gotten my MBA from Harvard and eventually kind of decided to switch over into fintech. So I had joined Venmo in the US post PayPal acquisition. And while I was sort of learning all about payments and fintech and building on top of legacy banking systems, I came across the Bitcoin white paper back in 2013 after this Verge article had helped sort of, you know, push it a little bit more mainstream. And, because of my some of the stuff that I had studied, it made just enough sense of what the paper was describing and solving sort of Byzantine General's problem. And that coupled with like the payments experience I was having at that time, I was like, you know what, this sounds really out there, but it's super interesting. And it's probably worth, following it and seeing what happens. And so I opened up, my Coinbase account at that time, which had sort of gone live about a year ago before that. And really just started investing and kind of following the news and the community that was forming around it. It was, even more Wild West at that time than it is today. And it was just like this idea virus that it just sat in my head and it just wouldn't let go. And so for a few years, I was just trading and following it nights and weekends until I built up enough conviction that this was both a technology and an asset class that was here to stay. And I wanted to make more of a career bet on it. So I ended up joining a company called eToro that was wanting to launch a crypto brokerage in the US. It's a pretty famous social trading application that's pretty well known globally at this point. But what was really interesting to me was that they wanted to go crypto first in their offering. And so it just gave me this chance to really learn the ins and outs of how a crypto brokerage works. And again, this is more on the regulated and CeFi side, and we can sort of get more into that. But for me, it was just a terrific experience. And just, I really kind of, built up a playbook for how these things operate and how do you bring both the technology and the regulatory and the business stack together to make it work. Now, fast forward a little bit, in 2019, my wife and I had decided for a bunch of professional and personal reasons that we wanted to relocate to Singapore and be in Southeast Asia. And so we made that move in December 2019, got here. I had joined Gojek at that time, now GoTo Group, had about 2 months of normalcy where I was commuting to Jakarta as well, and then the world shut down. But what was great about my experience at Gojek was that I did a few different tours of duty there. Initially, I was sort of tapped as the head of strategy for GoPay, their e-money arm, and was really focused on Indonesia. Then I eventually helped them do a license acquisition in Vietnam for their GoViet unit. And then ultimately was asked to run Coins PH in the Philippines as well. So that just gave me this really kind of accelerated exposure to a bunch of important markets in Southeast Asia, as well as kind of brought me back to my true passions around crypto. And from there, it was just an opportunity that came knocking with Coinbase to head up the region. And it was just a very easy decision, given that Coinbase was also a company that I had admired for a number of years. So that's how I got here.
Hassan, fantastic to hear, and what a background. Speaking of Southeast Asia, in regards to the crypto market, what type of business models are you seeing in the region?
Yeah, let's talk about Southeast Asia and maybe some of the market complexions for crypto in particular, and then we can talk about some of the business models that are being applied against the opportunities. So taking a step back, one of the cool things about, again, being at Coinbase is that it's a global company and we have a global presence. We're present in 100 plus countries. And so we do sort of look across all these different regions and try to figure out, hey, what are the kind of the areas or markets that are interesting to play in? And Southeast Asia consistently ranks as one of the most important markets for crypto. And there's a few different reasons for that. One of it really is just as a baseline that as a collection or sort of as a region, it's big enough in terms of having 650 million consumers and a big number of connected consumers as well, that it is meaningful sort of to have a presence in the market because you can sort of move the needle. I think that another interesting reason for why Southeast Asia is important is because many of the markets countries here were early to crypto and embraced crypto as opposed to being sort of distant from it or having a very kind of hostile posture. So as an example, Philippines has had a crypto licensing framework since 2017, which especially in crypto years is extremely early. It was maybe one of the first emerging markets that went ahead and did so. And so that has also allowed for just a lot of regulatory clarity relative to other jurisdictions, which allows for both kind of local license exchanges and brokerages to flourish, but also global companies to be able to come in and set roots and foundations and invest for the long term. And then finally, I think it's also a lot about like culture and attitude and demographics. So there, as you know, Southeast Asia has a relatively young tech-leaning population. And so even the demand profile has been really, really exciting to see having users sort of adopt and kind of go into crypto with a very open mind, not just in terms of speculating and sort of buying and trading crypto, but also what we're seeing is that they're starting to use crypto a lot as well, and we can get more into that. So in terms of the business models, I think that the where like crypto is in terms of its adoption cycle, it's still in that like early majority or that early adopter phase for the most part. And so what we're seeing is that what users are asking for is trusted and convenient ways to onboard crypto or to be able to convert their fiat into crypto so that they can then go ahead and do things with it. So as a result of that, brokerages and exchanges continue to be the dominant business model that is proven to be viable, even in these ascending markets. In addition to that, the other business model that's starting to really emerge as a result of the crypto economy in general getting more vibrant is what I would call like the rise of self-hosted wallets. So what we're also seeing is that users are getting fluent and adept enough after they've done a few trades to want to withdraw their assets to these self-hosted wallets and then go ahead and start deploying them into decentralized applications. So we're seeing a lot of uptake on self-hosted wallets as well, which I'm happy to go more into.
And Hassan, You know, I want to take a bit of a detour here. Within, you know, this question that you just answered, you touched on regulation, and can you talk a bit more as to how these business models across the Southeast Asia region are changing in relation to local regulations and such?
Sure. Regulation is a very important topic and very top of mind for crypto and Web3, because it's such a new breakthrough technology that's sort of still being worked through in terms of the full surface area of its use cases. What we're seeing is that it's usually financial regulators that usually will sort of step in and you know, claim coverage over crypto as a financial asset. And I think that that's an entirely valid point of view. But the one thing I would call out is because, again, blockchains are just a fundamental technology that can be built on top of. What we're also seeing is that even though sort of financial use cases, including trading and you know, eventually DeFi might be like the tip of the spear or the first phase of it, eventually it's you know, like feeling up different parts of an elephant. It's going to require a much more tailored and bespoke approach as to what parts of Web3 are regulated by what types of regulators. That said, within Southeast Asia, it is interesting to see that, for example, in the Philippines, crypto is regulated by the Central Bank of the Philippines, the BSP. And it's mostly sort of categorized initially as a currency, and now it's being categorized as a virtual asset, which is a term that FATF, which is a kind of supra government body, has you know, come up with. In Thailand, it's the SEC over there that regulates crypto, and they sort of take a bit of a security first approach towards it. And then finally, in Indonesia, there's the Ministry of Trade and Bappebti, as it's sort of known locally, has deemed it a commodity, and they are now regulating it as a commodities regulator, which is somewhat akin to how the CFTC in the U.S. You know, might view crypto assets. So there definitely are kind of different variations, and that's also why it's important to understand and engage with the regulators to help them educate about the kind of full surface area of what crypto and Web3 represents.
It's for sure going to be interesting to see how this develops over the course of the next few years, especially in Southeast Asia. That being said, going back to one of your previous answers, you talked about self-hosted wallets. Can you talk a bit more to this and how you are seeing the effect it's playing within the Southeast Asian market?
Definitely. This is a really fun and exciting topic. So I think there's a few layers here that maybe we should unpack. And first, we should just define self-hosted wallets in this context. So there are two constructs to kind of contrast against. One is a custodial experience where, you know, a centralized custodian like a Coinbase holds onto your assets. And then there's a self-custodied experience where you create your own self-hosted wallet. It could be on, you know, there's providers like Coinbase Wallet, MetaMask, Trust Wallet, Coin98. There's a whole bunch of options. But fundamentally, you just create your own wallet that you control because you own the seed phrase or the master key for it. And then once you move your assets onto your self-hosted wallets, effectively you have control over your own assets and you can choose to deploy them as you wish. The reason why that's important is because you need self-hosted wallets to interact with decentralized applications. So maybe for some of your listeners who you know have interacted with the apps like Uniswap or Compound or Aave, what you do is you go in and you sort of connect your self-hosted wallet with this app, and you need to have you know the certain types of assets in those apps to then go and interact with these applications, which are effectively smart contracts. So because of this structural feature in Web3, this has led to the rise of self-hosted wallets as new use cases have also emerged. And I want to draw particular attention to blockchain gaming and play to earn, because this is a phenomenal and interesting and completely unexpected use case that honestly, like a year and a half ago, almost nobody would have seen coming. You know, a lot of people were focused on decentralized finance, since a couple of years ago, and it made a lot of sense. It was very adjacent to the kind of whole trading experience. And people had always been experimenting with, hey, how can we sort of merge or graft these kinds of Web 2 type experiences with Web 3 technology, and what might that look like? And in particular, there's a game called Axie Infinity by a studio called Sky Mavis, which is based out of Vietnam. And they're the ones that like had the first kind of 0-to-1 moment for Web 3 gaming, where they figured out the right gaming experience as well as the right tokenomics and like the right kind of way to utilize NFTs to create this flywheel, which incentivized users to come on board, play the game, earn tokens in return, and then use clever mechanics to get new users into the game, which then sort of drove up sort of token prices as well. And it took them a lot of years to just sort of get those kind of basics down because nothing like that existed. But once that happened, it was just this like really breathtaking moment for the entire industry, because their user base, went from negligible, like it was literally like 300-ish daily actives about a year and a half ago, to their clocking, at their peak, they were clocking like almost 2 million dailies a few months ago. And that was reflected in their token price as well. So AXS is their governance token, which once it started sort of trading, it was, it was ranging between kind of 10 to 50 cents for a few months. And then it hit this sort of high of, over $100 a few months ago before kind of settling down right now. But, the prices aside, I think what it just sort of reflects is this interest in the market of what the potential behind Web3 gaming could be. And the other side of kind of building the game was that it's really the Philippines that has become the home of what is now called play to earn, which basically means sort of, playing the game in order to kind of, earn these token rewards. And in some ways, it could have happened anywhere. There wasn't like a structural or foundational reason why the Philippines would necessarily become the home of it. But I think the reason, two reasons for that are, one, there is a certain level of cultural adjacency to Vietnam and just general kind of, network overlap between what was being built over there and consumed in the Philippines. And then the second reason is that, again, because Philippines has had that regulatory clarity for crypto for a while, there's also just a certain attitude of, willingness to experiment and try these new things. And this incredible emergent behavior happened. And now there's like over 2 million blockchain gamers in the Philippines. And Axie Infinity is not the only game at this point. Like there's literally thousands of games that are being developed off of very similar patterns as well as new ones. And so I just expect that this is going to be a very fertile ground for really incredible experimentation for years to come. And I do expect that Southeast Asia will play a very, very leading role in it. And so as a result of this entire phenomena, gamify or blockchain gaming, self-hosted wallets have also, as a result of it, just undergone exponential growth in the region. When you want to get started on these games, the first thing you have to do is you have to download a wallet so that, whether you're buying the actual NFTs or you're just sort of playing the game and earning, then you need a place to kind of receive that token issuance that the underlying protocol is rewarding. And that comes straight into your self-hosted wallet, which is a very different user journey from your typical or traditional crypto user journey, which would be to go sign up for a centralized exchange and then convert your fiat into crypto. This is more about earning crypto or a time for money trade. And that's also why self-hosted wallets have just really burst into mainstream consciousness within crypto.
So I know we've kind of touched on this in snippets throughout this call, but how are crypto users and developer talent segmented across the region?
Yeah, there's a few different ways to cut this. I would say that the right now, especially for Southeast Asia, the majority of the interest is around what's sort of typically labeled as mass retail, just because these are very populous countries. So some of the stats here are, if you think back again to the Philippines, you know, it's roughly 107 million total population. There's about 60 million e-money users. And the reason why I use e-money users as sort of as a heuristic for what crypto adoption could ultimately be is because some of those kind of user journeys look very similar in that, you know, you have to be connected to the internet, you have to download an app, you have to pass KYC, you have to fund a wallet, and then eventually you go in and buy a crypto. And then today in the Philippines, there's, I think, about 15 million crypto users. In Indonesia, the numbers are potentials even bigger. You know, there's about 270 million population, about 120 million e-money users, and at last count, about 11 million crypto users. So I do think that, you know, within retail, I do expect that headroom to eventually get saturated because it's, again, it's multiple use cases. It's not just sort of trading, but eventually, I do see you know, crypto-based payments becoming more important, whether it's remittances or cross-border commerce or just domestic payments. And then there's, again, like other types of new use cases that are emerging as well. So we're going to have these you know, retail buyers that are starting their journey on CeFi and buying crypto. And then in parallel, we're seeing this catch-up of users that are earning crypto, that are roughly kind of within that same addressable population, but because their journey starts are different. Right now, I do consider them somewhat like separate segments, and especially would be marketed to in a fundamentally different kind of way. I think that the other demand segment is the institutional side. So on institutions, you can roughly kind of break these out into what I would call asset managers. So these could be traditional asset managers with crypto allocations, crypto native asset managers like crypto hedge funds, as well as just family offices and high net worth individuals that are you know, trading their own capital. And then you have the regulated financial institutions or just these bigger kind of corporates of the world. Many of them just want to kind of hold crypto on their treasury, like MicroStrategy or Tesla. And then finally, you have what's called these introducing brokers, which are somewhat of like a B2B2C play. It could be a payments platform that wants to add a crypto use case to its offering. It could be just a traditional, you know, equities broker that, again, is adding crypto. So those are also considered institutional in a sense. Many of those, especially pools of capital, you know, are in Singapore, Thailand. There's definitely family offices and just high net worth individuals everywhere. And then you have these scaled up payments platforms, you know, that at least there's one to three major ones in each of the big markets. And then finally, on the developer side, I would explicitly call out Vietnam for this one. I do think that Vietnam probably has the most talent density on the developer side in Southeast Asia. They've been exceptionally good at even kind of traditional gaming, but now they've gone all in on Web3 gaming as well. There's a lot of interesting protocols that have come out of Vietnam, a lot of interesting DeFi projects. So we're just seeing most of the builder action right now happening in Vietnam. Although one of my aspirations is to kind of increase that surface area and that level of developer activity for the Philippines and Indonesia in particular as well.
So Hassan, taking a step back, when looking at the overall Southeast Asian market, compared to countries such as the United States, where one business model works well, in Southeast Asia, it seems that in order to find product market fit, some would say you would have to tailor your product to the 11 markets in the region due to maybe local market level differences. How does Coinbase plan on tackling this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's a very valid observation. You know, even though we talk a lot about Southeast Asia as a region, you know, within SEA, there's just a lot of market variance, cultural variance, and attitudinal variance. So that needs to be taken into account when we're thinking about go-to-market strategies and product localization in particular. There are certain patterns that we know are effective and just need to be kind of translated across as a framework. So an example of that is, you know, we know that because some of our core service offering is around making buying crypto as easy as possible, part of the value proposition there needs to be that a user should be able to use the payment method that is most convenient for them. And one of the structural idiosyncrasies about Southeast Asia is that there are so many different payment methods in Southeast Asia. It just takes your breath away. For folks that are not used to the region, when they come here initially, they're payments professionals, they're just in shock at like how many e-wallets are proliferating across the region. And so there is certainly a level of effort and focus that needs to be given on, hey, how do I create that convenient and easy fiat on-ramp experience? So in the Philippines, again, you know, you might want to offer GCash as well as PayMaya. You want to have access to the real-time payments network, which is called sort of PesoNet and InstaPay. You want to be able to have users access cash top-ups via kind of physical retail channels like 7-Eleven and these pawn shops like Cebuana and M. Lulier. So you just have to understand like all of these kind of specific local idiosyncrasies when you're analyzing the market. I think the other consistent piece of localization that you have to do is localize KYC. And again, in contrast to the US, where you know national ID databases are very well structured and you know IDs are standardized and just you know the general level of education is at a certain point, it's not like that over here. It's only been recently in Indonesia, for example, that there's a digital national database called Asli that fintech providers can tap into. And even then, there's a lot of inconsistencies because, you know, even the government is still trying to get to 100%, you know, up-to-date coverage for its citizens. And then other kinds of things around, hey, like, are users kind of taking their photo the right way? Is there enough liveness in there? So I think just that KYC and user onboarding journey is a series of never-ending optimizations, honestly, that every sort of regulated tech platform kind of goes through. I think after that thing, and you start getting into these more of sort of the unknown unknowns of, hey, product stand up in this market the way that it's designed right now. Some of these things have to do with, hey, like if I have like a core and easy brokerage experience, for example, is that actually what the market wants? Or are they more price sensitive? So maybe we should offer up the order book experience first, but that's not really for, you know, regular users. But until we try out or we A/B test those things, we're not really gonna know what is the actual preferred user journey and how to kind of segment against that. One example of this is, Thailand, interestingly, is a very heavy trading market. It happens to be sort of somewhat like cultural and attitudinal, but Thai users are very, very proficient at figuring out trading concepts and order book exchanges. And so as a result of that, even though every other market has all these kind of big brokerages, and just to maybe explain that a little bit, when I say brokerage versus an exchange, what I mean is if you think about Charles Schwab versus the NASDAQ, when you go to buy like a share of Tesla, you would just log into your, you know, equities broker, which could be TD Ameritrade or Charles Schwab or eToro, and you get flashed a certain price. But the broker is then taking your order and then executing it on the actual trading venue. The trading venue in traditional securities and commodities are not really meant for retail users, but it's not like that for crypto, where users can actually directly access these order book exchanges, which is both a kind of a very unique benefit for those that want it, but it can also be overwhelming for those that don't know what they're doing. So back to the point there is that in Thailand, users have been surprisingly proficient in navigating order book exchanges and they get better rates on it. And that's the model that works in Thailand. Whereas in Indonesia, even though people are price sensitive, the brokerage model has shown to be the maybe better product market fit. So again, I think until you spend enough time on the ground and you really observe what's going on and you connect it to, again, like, you know, what are some of these kind of cultural attitudes or these kind of ingrained values that people are solving for, it's very, very hard to make these kind of, you know, high level decisions around it. And that's why time in market just matters so much in understanding these variations.
And Hassan, with venture capital funding more than doubling from $9.4 billion in 2020 to $27.5 billion in 2021 within the region, what is it that Coinbase is seeing in crypto in Southeast Asia, which has really caused them to move out there? What is the core thesis you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, we at Coinbase are very, very excited at the market prospects that we see in Southeast Asia. Overall, our mission is to increase economic freedom around the world. And so in order to achieve that mission, we want to be in the markets and the countries where we can, you know, provide and our services and deliver value to users, help them harness the power of crypto and Web3 to achieve their kind of economic goals as well. And for some of the reasons that I mentioned before of, you know, Southeast Asia being a populous region overall, having, you know, relatively high level of regulatory clarity in many of the major markets, and just a very attractive demand profile and adoption levels. I think for all of those reasons, we're very, very excited to be here and to increase our products and services in all these different markets. I think the venture capital profile and increased capital allocation is also reflective of many of these factors, where you know, we are seeing a lot of new startups emerge both on the kind of CeFi side as well as the crypto native side. They're happening in Vietnam, they're happening in Singapore, as well as many of the other major markets. And they're also, a lot of these new startups are also, you know, because they're from the region first, they also understand many of these products and user bases at a much deeper level. And you know, the markets are just sort of big enough, especially from a user base perspective, to support these kind of VC style scale ups. So I think that it's all of those factors that we are also excited about as well.
So Hassan, tell us a bit about some of the new products Coinbase hopes to launch in Southeast Asia in relation to its strategy around its product offerings, also taking into consideration localization factors.
Sure. So the way we think about our product set is that it has to eventually solve a problem for our users. And we've segmented our users into three categories. That would be consumers, institutional, and developers. And for each of these user types, you know, we have certain products that are quote unquote on the shelf that are being deployed, you know, even today worldwide. And then there's an additional level of localization effort that needs to be done as we continue to increase our commitment to these various markets. So on the retail side, because that, you know, in many ways is the most important one for Southeast Asia, we have both what I would call a regulated set of products, as well as products that are currently regulation exempt. And that would be specifically Coinbase Wallet, which is the self-custody wallet, as well as the new product that we announced just recently called NFT Marketplace, which also interacts with self-custodied wallets. In Southeast Asia, because of the uptake of self-hosted wallets, we are very excited at the prospect of getting Coinbase Wallet into the hands of as many users as possible, and having as many decentralized application developers accept Coinbase Wallet as a connection method. And we're working actively across a few different markets to increase that level of awareness and adoption. So that's something that we're very excited about. And we do believe that Coinbase Wallet is a differentiated and very exciting product that you know, enjoys the same level of trust because of the Coinbase brand behind it. And it has been sort of optimized to be very easy to use as well. One example of that is that we recently started supporting Solana on our Coinbase wallet. So before, it would be mostly just Ethereum and EVM compatible chains like Avalanche or Polygon or Optimism and then a few of those. But anytime that users wanted to go try anything on Solana, they would have to download a separate wallet and then store their assets, Solana assets separately. But now that we've integrated the two and we've brought those together, users can easily play their favorite games across Solana and Polygon and Avalanche by just using Coinbase wallet. So that's an example of you know, a particular sort of localization that we also undertook, recognizing that like gaming in particular is a big use case in this region, but it is multi-chain. You know, for users to have the best and easiest experience, we need to support all of these different chains. On the main Coinbase app, you know, which has sort of fiat channels, we are currently exploring different paths to market, which, you know, when required, we do intend to acquire licenses in local jurisdictions as well. So that tends to be a, you know, slightly longer cycle in terms of market entry, but we are pretty excited to, and hopefully we'll have something to announce in the coming quarters on that front as well. In addition to the retail side, I will also call out that we do have a full homegrown local APAC institutional team that is servicing all of our institutional clients out of our Singapore hub. So on the institutional side, the kinds of products that clients typically want is they want custody services, they want trade execution services, they want what's called as prime brokerage services, which is basically sort of a somewhat of a service desk, you know, which allows them to kind of go across different trading venues and get best execution. There's adjacent services like financing, you know, for margin, if that's what the requirement is. And then there's also certain things around like analytics and market intelligence that is all provided on the Coinbase institutional side. And that's all generally available today for all of our APAC clients and is serviced regionally out of Singapore. And then finally, on developers, we have a product or a platform called Coinbase Cloud, which allows for developers to easily spin up nodes on certain chains and then be able to deploy the applications that they're working on these chains very easily. So we have, so what's exciting is that Coinbase has this ecosystem of products and services that goes across, and many of them are, you know, available in Southeast Asia right away.
So are we going to see the launch of local stablecoins within the Southeast Asian region tied to local country currencies? And if so, will Coinbase have a play in this?
So that's a great question. Let's talk a little bit about why stablecoins are important, how they're structured, and then, you know, where the overall stablecoin market might be going and whether there's a place for Southeast Asian currencies in particular or non-USD currencies in general to play. So stablecoins are basically a, you know, a crypto asset that is pegged in value to a real world asset. And the first product market fit use case for pegged assets has been around pegging it to USD. We saw USDT as sort of the first primitive. And then we saw the rise of these algorithmic stablecoins like DAI, and now there's others, you know, like Luna Terra and a few others. And then there's also other, you know, blue chip stablecoins around USD like USDC. So far, the stablecoin market, it's almost sort of close to $200 billion total value locked at this point, which is very, very impressive, you know, if you consider that it was sort of off of a standing start a few years ago. But if you zoom out a little bit, and maybe if you look across sort of the entire traditional FX trading market, which is the largest financial market in the world, FX has trading volumes of around 6 trillion in daily vol, which is completely mind-blowing if you just take that as a reference point. And then the second, I think, part is that The reason why like stablecoins are just USD denominated right now is somewhat because of the short operating history. And it made sense to start with USD as somewhat of the kind of the world's primary reserve currency. But I do think that eventually other types of stablecoins will have their place in the crypto ecosystem as well. And Southeast Asian currencies, as well as just pretty much sort of every other fiat currency, will have a mirrored representation in the form of a stablecoin on chain. There are a few different flavors of this. It could be, you know, fully fiat-backed stablecoins that are issued by a private company or a startup. There are also central bank digital currencies that are being explored pretty vigorously. And then there's these algorithmic stablecoins, which are being experimented with. So, you know, some variation or some flavor of these is going to hit the market in every market at some point. And I think the reason why there's a reason for existence for these is because, you know, in the local market, when you want to pay for goods and services, you want to pay for it and you want to hold value in that unit of account that those goods and services are denominated in. And so, you know, like in the Philippines, for example, like if you're getting a yield on your DeFi, you know, locked assets, today that yield gets generated either in like a native token or in a USD denominated stablecoin. But I do think that eventually, you know, as people get more comfortable with it, in the Philippines, for example, they will want to know what their peso or their PHP denominated yield looks like, because that's what they're going to need to pay for their, you know, their rent or groceries or paying their friends or you know, what have you. So I think that is what the equilibrium state will eventually look like. There are some interesting projects in the region. One that I'll maybe call out is called BlueJay Finance, which is explicitly looking to launch Southeast Asia denominated stablecoins, because I think they view the problem space in a similar way, and they think that this is where the market is going to move towards.
And Hassan, to wrap up our call with the last question for the day, what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you have had so far in life?
Well, what I would say about, particularly about being in crypto and Web3 is, you know, at least for me personally, the reason I'm in this space for the long term is because when I look around, I don't see any other technology that is as exciting. I mean, to be in sort of the participate in the early days of what, you know, looks like is going to be the next internet is about as exciting as it gets. And further, I think the other reason why it's so interesting is because there is this sort of open access to these opportunities. You know, if you have a basic device and a connection, you can go and you know, interact with these like dApps and just the open crypto economy. Without being intermediated or without anyone, you know, telling you otherwise. So there's a lot of empowerment that comes along with it to be able to, you know, get more of your fate and control your fate in your own hands. And so I think my general advice is, if you haven't yet, do take the time to study and play around with crypto. And secondly, because this is a permissionless and open environment, the best way to learn is just by doing. You can participate. There's something in here for everyone at this point, whether it's infrastructure or middleware or tooling or analytics or, you know, applications like blockchain gaming or decentralized wireless or decentralized social. There's just so much happening in this space that it's almost impossible not to be excited about it. But I would encourage everyone to at least try for yourselves, as opposed to just reading what maybe the mainstream media has to say, and see for yourself whether you like it or not, make a decision.
Hassan, for people out there who are interested in maybe catching a cup of coffee with you or speaking with you, what would be the best points of contact?
Yeah, for those folks who are wanting to get in touch, the easiest place is Twitter. My handle is @Hassan_NY. I'm usually pretty online. I'm pretty accessible on DMs. So that would be the best place to start. If you're local in Singapore and you want to grab a cup of coffee, maybe you're working on something interesting, maybe you want to learn more about this case, happy to do so as well. Again, Twitter is probably the best place to maybe kind of initiate, and we can take it from there.
Hassan, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kunal. Much appreciated.
This podcast is brought to you by PyTone, an Asian-based open-source enterprise software company. PyTone offers a suite of software applications and infrastructure services to scholars and universities. Thank you.